As mentioned, the Isle of Wight Festival was famous for many reasons, not least of which the fact that it was on a tiny, sleepy island, English island. And then, having come almost from absolutely nowhere, in 1969, it managed to coax Bob Dylan out of retirement to play at it. And in 1970, it generally put together what's regarded as one of the greatest lineups of all time: Jimi Hendrix, Miles Davis, The Who, John Baez, Joni Mitchell, and many, many more. The story of it is fascinating, and it's told in a new book called When the World Came to the Isle of Wight, 1970, The Last Great Event. The author of that book and the founder of the festival as well, Ray Folk, joins us on the phone. Ray, how are you tonight?
Good evening. Nice to talk to you.
You too. It's an incredible story that starts in 1968 when you're really just trying to raise funds for a swimming pool.
That's right. It started off with a charity kind of endeavour. The charity pulled out before we got the event on because they started to get worried about hippies and bad publicity. And so they left it with us to take it over ourselves. So that's how it all began.
Nice, modest start. it didn't take you long to put your name on the map, though. I mean, in 69, Bob Dylan hadn't played in years.
It was a great coup, you know. I mean, it was a really great piece of luck and everything to have that happen. It chimed in with Woodstock. They're putting Woodstock in Dylan's backyard to try and get him to come out and play. And he really resented that. And we just happened to be bidding for him at the same time. It was a time when he was thinking about, shall I get back to work or not? You know, it's been 3 years, no concerts, nothing, and need to get back. And we didn't really sort of know the detail, but Woodstock were desperately trying to get him on there. And he resented the whole notion of Woodstock.
Right.
So that was our good fortune.
So you wonder if he seems quite an ornery person, it would seem. I wonder if he resents winning the Nobel Prize as well.
Well, that's a good question. I mean, there's a lot of speculation and all sorts of ideas on that.
Yeah. Might explain a great deal why he hasn't got back to him. Why did he respond to you, though? What was it you offered him that Woodstock didn't?
Well, I guess that he liked the look of our outfit. We were modest people. We had a small island site. He thought it was going to be quite low profile, I think. He didn't like the idea of the jamboree of Woodstock, you know, that was just going to be so massive. And he didn't realize that we had a good publicity department and it would become a world event. but nevertheless, I mean, we offered a holiday to him and his family, a trip over on the QE2 and, you know, everything you could imagine, chauffeurs and nannies for the children. We put together a whole package, which I think they liked the look of.
Right.
I don't think we certainly weren't outbidding anybody on money. There were plenty of people bidding big money to get him to come to concerts.
Right. You never know what's going to float somebody's boat, do you?
Yeah, you don't. And I guess we were very young and naive, and we thought this sort of stuff was going to be good, and maybe it just chimed with him.
Right. It puts you in a position where you're suddenly on the map. You've gone from trying to raise funds for a swimming pool to having Bob Dylan playing on the Isle of Wight. And then, like the classic band syndrome where you do one great album, people expect another one. It puts you in 1970 trying to put together the next one. Under extreme pressure, would you say?
It was. And I think this was really the driving point. I mean, if you look at the whole picture, looking back from some distance now, 68, we didn't do very well. We didn't get many people to cross the water to come to the island. We're relying on Isle of Wight people. There aren't that many young people there. And we're kind of a bit burnt by that. And we knew that we had to have a big superstar to get people to come across the water. Well, there was nobody in 1970 that was going to follow Dylan with that kind of strength, that kind of enormous sort of act that would draw people across the water in those numbers. And in the end, we just resorted to the idea of getting what we call the raft of artists, the biggest artists in the world, in the next tier down, if you like.
Right.
So all of the acts in the next tier down, as I call them, people like Leonard Cohen, Joni Mitchell, Jimi Hendrix, they're all people who do concerts in normal concert halls across Britain.
Right.
And so, you know, audience could go to those people without having to get on a ferry to go to the Isle of Wight. So I think it was just the accumulation of so many of them, plus the reputation of Bob Dylan the year before and all the kind of publicity surrounding that. And it kind of got really big, much bigger than we ever thought it would be.
5 days, 600,000 people.
Well, those figures, 600,000, I think it's probably a little bit over the top. Certainly bigger than Woodstock, whatever way you cut it. And it was a huge event.
Let's say it's 500,000 people. They're getting to the Isle of Wight. In what way? Is it a ferry ride? Or
yeah, it's a ferry. I mean, there are several ferries. There are car ferries. And the car ferries were just given over to bring people only, you know, that sort of thing.
Right.
And they're all standing on the deck. You couldn't do that today because they've got regulations about numbers of passengers.
It sounds like a hippie version of Dunkirk.
It was a bit like that. I think it was described as that. I mean, headlines talked about Dunkirk all the time.
Amazing. But you didn't get it easy, did you?
No, I mean, the 1970 story was a very different story to 69. And the 69, our first volume is all about getting Dylan and all about Bob Dylan and what that involved and what that did for Dylan and what it did for us and so on. 70 was a very different story. It was a story of doing battle with local politicians and local opponents who didn't want the festival.
Right. Why didn't the politicians want it?
Oh, they just thought it was just so out of place on their glorious sort of little island, you know. They just didn't think it fitted. And there were no complaints, really, from the police or from any sort of serious authorities, you know, like the health authorities, anybody like that.
Yeah.
It was like the NIMBYism of not in my backyard, thank you. And they didn't like the look of hippies. They thought it was political. They thought that there was a lot of drugs involved and all those sort of usual arguments. And they thought it was bad for the island's image with their tourist trade.
Right.
Which is kind of ridiculous. But, you know, that was the way people were thinking. And they were determined to stop us. We had high court injunctions and lots of campaigns against us. And it was very, very difficult to get it on.
Right. You also had the islanders, reactionary islanders.
That's what I'm talking about, the reactionary islanders. And there's a great number of retired military on the Isle of Wight.
Yeah.
Senior military, like vice admirals and colonels and people like that, who were a lot of them on the councils, you know, and they were just determined that this wasn't what they wanted on their quiet retirement sort of island.
Right. It was getting kind of out of hand, though, wasn't it? I mean, there was talk of local opponents trying to sabotage the site and death threats.
Yep. I mean, my mother had a death threat and, you know, threatened to burn a house down at least. You know, they sort of, I mean, silly things that we didn't take too seriously, although we obviously reported them. But we had a vehicle or two smashed up on site and they got it was very polarized. I mean, one could think today about the American election as a kind of polarization going on between Trump and Clinton. You know, there was that kind of thing that you're either one side or the other. And there's very fierce opposition going on.
Right. Radicals travelling from London and the continent determined to undermine the festival.
Right, that was the next stage. I mean, the next part of the story is when the festival finally got going, or when we really sort of got the site nearly built, then radicals started arriving and they thought it should be a free festival. So we had that to contend with, and that became a big part of the story. You know, how do you deal with that? And we kept the festival running. I don't think the audience was very much aware of what we were putting up with. We were defending the thing. We kept the show going. Every artist appeared. Almost everyone was there having encores and, you know, had a fantastic time. So from that point of view, it was good. But we had a lot of trouble to deal with to, you know, keep the thing intact.
Right. I can't help but wonder when you put, these are the early days of festivals. When we go to festivals these days, you have gourmet food very often, toilets, showers, really impressive tents. You know, the boutique festivals have become very, very well organized. What was it like back then when everything had to come, you know, on ferries? What were the facilities like?
Right. Well, where do I begin? You talked about several sort of things there. The glamping, as it's now called.
Yeah.
At festivals where you can hire a very expensive marquee or a tent or and, you know, you've got all the showers, hot showers and everything else. Those are very, very expensive, and that's not for the ordinary festival goer. For the ordinary festival goer nowadays, the toilets are the kind of cubicle chemical toilets,
yeah,
which do get pretty disgusting. Now, the toilets we had plenty of them. They were the deep trench latrines where you the army style, where you got a really deep trench and then you got these sort of superstructure above it, which are cubicles. I think in many ways they're far less objectionable than what you put out with today. And, you know, that was all very good. The food was very basic. We organized the catering ourselves for the most part, and we had an army kitchen. We had lots of outlets. And the reports from the health authorities and the county authorities afterwards was that the food was satisfactory, it was fairly priced, and it was safe to eat. Sort of from their point of view, it was fine.
Yeah.
I'm not saying it was gourmet food, but it was good basic stuff that was, you know, decently priced. So I don't think we let down on that score in 1970.
Right.
We had problems in 69 with big queues for food and big queues for toilets. So those two things we did deal with satisfactorily
right.
in 1970.
And obviously the politicians were worried about drug use and the crowd's behaviour. How were they?
Well, the crowd behaviour was superb. The police report was very good afterwards. In fact, the police report came to the aid of all UK festivals when they gave evidence to the House of Commons committee. They were set up to look into festivals. They're about, you know, that they banned the Isle of Wight Festival in Parliament afterwards.
Yes.
They got an Isle of Wight bill through to stop it. But they tried to make this thing go national. And the police from the Isle of Wight and the health authorities from the Isle of Wight gave their evidence and said, look, you know, there's no problem. We don't need further regulation. We need negotiation, not regulation. And they ditched the bill.
Right.
So irony of ironies, you know, the Isle of Wight ended up saving the festival sector.
Wow.
But can I just go back to what you were saying about festivals now and festivals
sure.
then? I think the big difference was that the audience, I mean, festivals now, I got very high regard for because they are very good. You know, they've got wonderful things going on and a huge variety of stuff and lots of stages. They're expensive, but they are very good. And I think in the end, they're probably reasonable value for money. But festivals then, I think, were much more of a pilgrimage, not so much just for the entertainment. I think nowadays it's an entertainment thing. In those days, it was a pilgrimage to see people who had something to say. You know, they're musicians who had a message in their songs. And obviously Bob Dylan in particular, and then going through to Jimi Hendrix and Joni Mitchell, Leonard Cohen, all these people had something to say.
Yeah.
And they were their gods and goddesses that they would go on a pilgrimage to see. And I'm not sure you've got that today.
I mean, right.
Well, you certainly haven't got the counterculture anyway, which
yeah.
is what all this was a part of.
The audience has described it as a magical, life-changing experience. And it's been written about as being one of the ultimate 60s trips. And, you know, for young people looking for a kind of different life or a better life, this was one of the last great hurrahs of the 60s. But the performers, for me, looking at it, are at this remove, I find it mind-boggling. You see Jim Morrison at the absolute height of his powers, Leonard Cohen looking like the coolest man in the universe, which he still is.
Yeah.
To this day. What was your memory of all those performances?
Well, to start with, I mean, most of the big names that we had at the Isle of Wight are still big names today. They haven't
yeah.
faded, as you've just pointed out. I mean, say Miles Davis, for instance, you know, I mean, it's still a huge name
yeah.
in history. I mean, my recollection of them were that they were really excellent, you know, top-rate performers that had a great following. And they had durability, you know, they did last.
Yeah. Jimi Hendrix, as it turned out, only had a few weeks to live during this. How was he on the day?
Well, I should tell you one thing. That is, at least 9 or 10 of these performances appear in individual movies, documentaries of their performance, which are available. You know, they're all on DVDs, so you can see what they're like. And the Jimi Hendrix performance is there. You know, there's a 2-hour DVD to see. It wasn't his best performance ever. It was kind of, there's a sadness about it, I think. It was quite melodic in places. But, you know, the audience loved it, and he kept going for a couple of hours. You know, he didn't flag.
Yeah.
He started off badly, and he did a restart after 20 minutes, and then he really got going, and he kept going for the rest of the set. And I think he was exhausted afterwards. A lot of people said he had to be carried off and he was on drugs and things like that, but I don't think that was true. I don't think there was evidence of that. You know, there's evidence to the contrary, in
right.
fact.
The photographs of him in particular are iconic and amazing. And what I see is things you wouldn't see these days. When he's playing, the audience is within feet of him and are climbing all over the PA and spread out all around him. It's almost like he's playing in a club.
That's right. I mean, there were so many people on stage just surrounding him. And I guess the security nowadays wouldn't allow that sort of thing remotely, not anywhere near.
And I know they have their safety concerns, but I know from a performer point of view, it's putting that audience as close to you as they can humanly get, which is the way you want it, the way all audiences want. It's an amazing book and lovingly put together. You describe it as the last great event. Why is that?
Well, when we're running into all the difficulties with the councils beforehand, we saw the writing on the wall that, okay, we're going to get this festival on somehow, but it's unlikely we could do it again, that they really would stop us for 1971. And in fact, they did get their Act of Parliament through in time. So we started advertising it as the last great event. Uh-huh. You know, this is the last hurrah. And it was kind of, it was the end of an era. I think we sensed that as well. And so when you look through all our press cuttings and advertising, you can see that the top of the hour is the last great event sort of crept in about a month beforehand. And it's kind of quite a good title in a way. I mean, obviously, not literally the last great event, but it was the last great event of that kind.
Yeah, well, it's funny as you say that. The book fell open on Chapter 11, The Aftermath and the Isle of Wight Act. And it's just a photograph of naked hippies, male and female naked hippies. You didn't see much of that stuff in the 70s, you didn't.
No, it all changed quickly.
And they put their clothes back on after this.
Yeah, I mean, what's extraordinary is that, I mean, David Bowie is heralded as being sort of a great innovator, which of course he was. But in a way, he was part of the whole glam rock thing that came in a few years later. And it just killed off the whole counterculture.
Yeah.
And it became really fashion based for a while.
Right.
And the music lost its kind of the intellectual dimension about social justice and making a better world and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Which to me is very sad. And again, I'm not knocking David Bowie. I'm not knocking a lot of those acts who are wonderful. But I do lament the passing of the counterculture because I think there's a lot of good. There's a lot of good happening there, a lot of good to come out of it.
Yeah, I agree 100%. Ray, thanks very much for joining us. It's a wonderful book. When the World Came to the Isle of Wight, the last great event, 1970, Jimi Hendrix and Jim Morrison. I think I'll play a bit of Jimi Hendrix for them because I think it'll be only right now. Ray, thanks very much.
Well, thanks for talking to me. Thanks.
Thank you indeed.
Bye-bye.
Bye now. Bye.